University law professors, but also from Charles S. Fairchild and Everett Pepperell Wheeler at Constitutional League headquarters in New York. Both Fairchild and Wheeler were prominent corporate lawyers and veterans of the male anti-suffrage movement. Both men had impressive resumes and were highly respected in legal circles. Wheeler, a leader of the civil service reform movement and a founder of the American Bar Association. Fairchild, known for his successful work for banking and railroad clients. They brought their legal skills into the suffrage fight through the Constitutional League, which they'd launched after the Anti's embarrassing defeat in the 1917 New York suffrage referendum. They both possessed nimble legal minds, which they devoted to developing novel attacks on the Federal Amendment, and now on maneuvers to prevent, or even reverse, ratification. The Anti's legal assault was assisted by a new ally. On the very day that Mrs. Catt began her speaking tour, the Chattanooga Times published the opinion of Foster V. Brown, one of that city's most distinguished lawyers, a former U.S. congressman and attorney general, contending that sitting Tennessee legislators would indeed be violating their oath of office by voting on ratification in the special session. That Brown was known as a champion of woman suffrage and supporter of the Federal Amendment made the opinion all the more potent, and for the Suffs, more damaging. The Antis quickly printed leaflets featuring Brown's statement and circulated them around the state, handy ammunition for the Anti-delegation visiting Nashville's top lawyers. The Anti-ambassadors were able to sway enough of those lawyers that within days, a Tennessee Constitutional League was formed. The Nashville lawyers and businessmen organizing the Constitutional League, several of whose wives were active Antis, then enlarged the organization by contacting their colleagues in other cities and distributing enrollment blanks around the state. The Tennessee Constitutional League, comprising both Democrats and Republicans, with John Vertrees heading the board of directors, vowed to protect the letter and spirit of our Constitution from the attacks of its enemies. Betty Graham slipped into Memphis with no entourage and no welcoming delegation to greet her, but she made her entry with a certain theatrical flair that the press couldn't resist. 110 pounds of femininity to hit legislators for vote. Young militant arrives to make canvas. Is hunger striker. Miss Graham did time for suffrage cause. Betty Graham wasn't shy about being a militant, and not coy about why she'd come to Memphis. She wore her prison pin, and she made her intentions clear. The reporters got the hint. Here's just a little inside tip for Shelby County legislators, the Memphis newspaper article advised. There's a real militant suffragist in town for the purpose of calling on each one of you and securing your written pledge to ratify the suffrage amendment. You'd better sign up, because she means business. And she has a record to back up her determination. She's been in jail 3 times and hunger-struck for 10 days, lest timorous legislators might suddenly feel the necessity of leaving town. Fear not, the news article continued. This militant was not what a legislator might expect. She's young and she's pretty. And to add to the triumvirate of femininity, she's stylish. Betty Graham was all of those things, but not only those things. She was also clever, wily, intrepid, and fiercely dedicated to her cause. The photograph of Graham accompanying the article, she provided the photo, proved the reporter's point. It was a close-up studio portrait, the kind movie stars used, Graham's lovely face framed by a stylish feather cloche hat. She enjoyed the role of ingenue agitator, and if unsuspecting legislators simply saw a pretty face, then woe be to them. Graham excelled in the arts of direct action. Graham had aspired to become an actress and singer, but abandoned her stage career for a part in the suffrage movement. Raised in Portland, Oregon, she discovered the cause at college, then moved to New York City to further her theatrical career. She had just landed a part on Broadway when she answered Alice Paul's call for volunteers to join the Silent Sentinels, picketing the White House in November 1917. Graham and her younger sister Alice took the train down to Washington, arriving at party headquarters just as the picketing crew was setting off. Drawn into the excitement, Betty and Alice Graham grabbed the last two picket poles and joined the protest. They soon found themselves in a Black Maria and carted off to jail. The sisters were sentenced to 30 days in the infamous Occoquan workhouse, and, claiming they were political prisoners, joined in a suffragist hunger strike. They watched their comrades beaten by prison guards, thrown into isolation cells, forbidden to speak, read, or write. Pens and pencils were confiscated. The squalor and starvation weakened them, but also stiffened their resolve and strengthened their loyalty to Miss Paul. The intensity of the experience convinced them both to devote themselves to the Woman's Party. Alice joined the headquarters press staff, and Betty became a fixture on the picket line. She was imprisoned two more times, deepening her pride in her prison pin and earning a berth on the prison special. She met Sue White on that trip, and they struck up a fast friendship. That month of traveling together in the railroad car, packed into little sleeping berths, emerging in each city dressed in their prison outfits to lead a parade, speak on street corners, or conduct a big rally, was an experience they'd always share. Miss Paul dispatched Graham to 11 states during the ratification campaign. Graham was in New Jersey for that uncomfortably close decision, and in Delaware for that disaster. She and Sue were side by side in the losing battle in Alabama, and picketed together at the Republican National Convention in Chicago earlier in the summer. Now they were reunited in Tennessee. Graham unpacked her bag in Memphis. She had her list of men to see. She began her calls. "Sentiment in favor of ratification is running high, and everyone seems to think we will win," she wrote in her first report to Alice Paul. "But so did they in Delaware. And sentiment doesn't get votes." Like an impatient fisherman, Sue White wanted to reel in Seth Walker quickly. He was the slippery sort, but he was an essential catch. As Speaker of the House, he had enormous visibility. Legislators would be watching his movements and signs on the question of ratification. His position also endowed him with all sorts of parliamentary powers that he could use to ease, or obstruct, the passage of the amendment through the General Assembly. Walker was a Roberts man. He sided with the governor on most policies and dutifully pushed through the administration's legislative agenda. He'd made that forceful speech on the lower house floor in favor of limited woman suffrage last year, and he'd given every indication that he would support ratification. But now that it was time to actually sign a pledge form, he was balking. He said he needed more time to investigate the constitutionality of the present legislature acting on ratification. White feared Walker had swallowed the anti's bait. She'd sent Betty Graham into Walker's district in Lebanon, about 25 miles east of Nashville, to talk to his political friends and associates. Graham had stopped in Nashville for a few days en route to Memphis and was a great help. White was stretched so thin, running the headquarters office, juggling orders from Miss Paul in Washington, maintaining close contact with the party's lobbyists in Ohio, sending detailed instructions to her field deputies around the state, all while coordinating the legislative canvass, keeping an eye on anti-activities, and getting her own assigned men pledged. White had never before been in charge of a state campaign all by herself, as the senior officer on the ground, as well as the local political expert. And this was shaping up to be a campaign like no other. She was nervous about making a mistake. She tried not to feel overwhelmed, but she was anxious for Miss Paul to finally come to Nashville and take charge. In the meantime, it was up to her. Seth Walker was tall and strapping, with the trim physique of the college athlete he'd once been. He was only 28 years old, still something of a neophyte in the legislature, but his reputation as a clever lawyer, together with his canny political instincts and his loyalty to the governor, quickly boosted him into the speaker's chair. He was a solid family man, married with kids. He was unapologetically ambitious. His career was well launched, as in addition to his law office and legislative post, he served as an attorney for the Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis Railway. Graham found Walker in his district office in Lebanon. He was polite but abrupt. If he could convince himself that there were no legal obstructions to ratifying, he promised her he could then see clear to support the amendment. He was looking into it. Graham reported all this to Sue White. Walker was still at large. Anne Dallas Dudley, the savvy doyenne of Nashville Suffs, who was helping Catherine Kenny keep some semblance of order at the League of Women Voters ratification headquarters, was also angling for Seth Walker. He'd been one of the unexpected heroes during the partial suffrage debate in the legislature last year. Such a thrilling surprise. And she had high hopes for his ratification support now. He was a man whom others followed. But he hadn't responded to the poll. He hadn't sent in his pledge. He wasn't answering her messages. Dudley consulted with Mrs. Catt, and they hatched a plan. Get Governor Cox, the new captain of the Democratic ship, to bring Seth Walker on board. Dudley wired to the National Association's liaisons to the candidate in Ohio, asking them to deliver a message to Cox. Please urge Seth Walker to be your personal representative in the Tennessee legislature. Ask him to lead the fight for ratification in the House. Action is urgent. Sue White took a different tack in her pursuit of Walker, badgering him, appearing in his office, flooding him with legal opinions on the validity of ratifying. Finally, in the very last days of July, he informed White that he'd decided that there were no constitutional barriers to acting on ratification, and he would support the amendment. White was elated. She wired the news to Alice Paul and called Anita Politzer in Knoxville, whooping with delight. She issued an announcement to the press. Speaker Walker to support ratification, the headlines read. Miss Sue White was credited with the conversion. With Walker secured, the Suffs could move to the next step. There is a formal choreography to amending the U.S. Constitution, an elaborate little dance set in motion as soon as both houses of Congress pass a joint resolution proposing a new article for inclusion. It must be signed by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, then sent by the Secretary of State to the governors of each state. The governor presents the proposed amendment to the presiding officers of the state legislature, convened in regular or extraordinary session, and these officers introduce it into their respective houses for consideration and ratification. This dance can be tripped or stalled at any of several key steps, by a governor who chooses not to convene his legislature, by legislative officers employing parliamentary maneuvers to block forward motion, or by a few hostile lawmakers intent on throwing the proceedings off balance. The Tennessee suffragists couldn't afford to allow any such missteps, and even if they still had some doubts about whether Governor Roberts would keep his promise and play his part, they needed to secure their next set of necessary partners— the speakers of the General Assembly. They chose Anne Dudley to fill the dance card. With a formal flourish, she, on behalf of the four official ratification committees, the Tennessee League of Women Voters, Democratic Women, Republican Women, and the Men's Ratification Committee, but not the Woman's Party, invited Senate Speaker Andrew Todd and House Speaker Seth Walker to introduce the federal amendment into their respective houses of the legislature. Both speakers accepted Mrs. Dudley's invitation. Seth Walker confidently predicted that the legislature would ratify swiftly. Meanwhile, Anita Politzer moved on to Knoxville, where she made her base at the Farragut Hotel and made herself a charming pest around town. She bantered with the fellows hanging around the courthouse. She cracked wise with the newspaper guys. She wangled appointments with the district party leaders. She found out which politicians were dining together, who was talking to whom. She found a crucial ally in State Senator Erastus Eugene Patton, who offered Politzer advice, assistance, and useful warnings. See this man, avoid that one, make sure these businessmen are with you. Patton also insisted, you must reach Herschel Candler. Candler was admired in the Senate and respected as a man of strong, forcefully articulated convictions. But Candler had already made his stance pretty clear.
I will not perjure myself to open violation of the Constitution of the State of Tennessee, he denounced. I unalterably oppose suffrage and shall vote against the bill.
While Candler was already well known to have anti-inclinations, sowing legality doubts among his colleagues made him even more destructive. As she circulated through the environs of Knoxville, Pulitzer found that the legislators she approached seemed more and more skittish. Those who'd not yet pledged tried strenuously to dodge. Those who had already pledged favorably now hedged. I fear the Republicans are holding back, Pulitzer wrote to Alice Paul. Her suspicions were confirmed when the Harding Coolidge Republican League, a Washington-based campaign group, conducted a telegraphic poll of Republicans in the Tennessee legislature during the first days of August, and reported to state and national party leaders, it does not look good. Republican legislators were claiming constitutional objections, which is obviously only an excuse, the Harding Coolidge Leaguers said bluntly, and the national party was just sitting on its hands. Suggest that you put all forces in motion for ratification, the telegram continued. If Tennessee fails to ratify, the women will certainly blame the Republicans. The Harding Coolidge boosters sent an even more dismal assessment directly to their candidate. Situation in Tennessee legislature seems worse from Republican viewpoint, they reported to Harding. We now know that majority Republican members are definitely against suffrage amendment, although five of those men voted for suffrage last year. It is possible that women all over the country are now beginning to believe that Republican opposition in Nashville will be responsible for defeat of the amendment. They begged him to take a more active role. Suggest that a personal telegram from you to each Republican member of legislature will undoubtedly result in all voting for the amendment. Do not believe that anything else will result in solid Republican support. But the Harding Coolidge men were sorely disappointed by the tepid response they received from their candidate.
You can understand why I cannot consistently urge Tennessee legislators to vote for ratification without knowing their reasons for such commitment as they have made, Harding dissembled. The situation is being reported to national headquarters, where it will be given attention at once.
The Harding Coolidge League was so frustrated by Harding's response that they leaked the correspondence. Women's Party headquarters in Washington got hold of it and released the exchange of telegrams to the press. Tepid Harding was in hot water again. Facing less resistance than Anita Pulitzer was encountering in East Tennessee did not mean that Betty Graham could take it easy. Tired unto death, she reported to Paul. Arose 6:30, motored 75 miles. In her travels to pledge the area's state legislators, Graham came across a thin, dapperly dressed 30-year-old Memphis delegate named Joseph Hanover, who not only eagerly signed his pledge to ratify, but was willing to make significant sacrifices to help achieve ratification. Once Graham ventured beyond the protected precincts of Crump's Shelby County into the surrounding Mississippi River Delta towns, things looked grimmer. At present, I am truly apprehensive, Graham wrote to Paul in the first days of August, because these Southern Democrats are concerned that their allegiance is just to the state constitution, and they'd break their oath of office by voting to ratify. So many who voted for presidential suffrage will not vote for SBA this session, Graham reported, using the Woman's Party favored name for the federal amendment, honoring their patron saint, Susan B. Anthony. Graham's early optimism was fading. Tennessee was in danger of slipping away, she feared. The Woman's Party sent Catherine Flanagan to Johnson City, in the northeast region of the state, near the tip of the Pointing Finger section that poked toward North Carolina. Her assignment was to extract pledges from the candidates running for vacant legislative seats, get them on record. If elected, I will vote to ratify the federal suffrage amendment. It was just the kind of advanced pledge the antis were railing about. Flanagan was a slight woman, 31 years old, with auburn hair, a pale complexion, and a broad, toothy smile. When she wasn't on the road as a Woman's Party organizer, or in prison, she lived with her widowed mother in Hartford, Connecticut. She'd worked as a stenographer and had been secretary of the Connecticut chapter of the National Association until the time, in the summer of 1917, that she decided to use her vacation to serve on the Woman's Party picket line at the gates of the White House. To those who knew Flanagan well, this wasn't so surprising. Her father had been active in the Ireland Home Rule movement of the late 19th century, forced to flee to America as a political exile. The Irish Easter Uprising of spring 1916 was still fresh in Catherine's mind in August 1917, when she decided to cast her lot with the suffrage group willing to fight and be imprisoned for women's freedom. Her father would have been proud. She was arrested for obstructing traffic and sentenced to 30 days in the fetid Occoquan workhouse. Her picketing actions were condemned by many of her colleagues in the Connecticut branch of the National Association, but applauded by others, including Katharine Houghton Hepburn, president of the state suffrage organization. Flanagan's imprisonment split Connecticut's suffragists, and following her release, Flanagan joined Hepburn in forming a Connecticut unit of the Woman's Party. She went out to Montana to work on Jeanette Rankin's campaign for re-election to the Congress in 1918, and then Miss Paul dispatched her to the tough ratification states, West Virginia, Delaware, Vermont, and her own impossibly frustrating Connecticut. Now she was in Tennessee, sporting her prison pin. She set out to find her men. Today I drove over 30 miles in a jitney from Johnson City to visit two uncommitted legislators, she reported to Miss Paul. One of them had no telephone and lived many miles down a badly rutted road. 2 miles from the lawmaker's house, she had to abandon the jitney and walk, as the road was impassable. She was drenched by thunderstorms, but finally made it to his door. He wanted to vote for ratification, he told her, but was afraid he'd be violating his oath. He refused to pledge, but promised to deliberate on the matter. Flanagan came away encouraged. I am sure we're going to win him over. The antis were equally sure she would not. About 100 miles from where Flanagan was stationed, Anita Politzer kept up a punishing pace. She was managing a sprawling workshop of East Tennessee Republicans, working from their office desks or kitchen tables, telephoning, writing, and wiring their friends on behalf of ratification. She circulated among them, prodding them into action, keeping them on task. If they dilly-dallied on their assignments, delayed contacting someone they'd promised to approach, Politzer was over their shoulder in a flash. She had little patience for slackers. When one high-level politician, a U.S. congressman, promised her he'd try to get hold of Herschel Candler, whom Politzer had still not managed to locate, and then failed to do so, she was in no mood to accept the congressman's feeble excuse. He'd tried to call Candler in Athens, but no luck. Politzer took hold of the congressman's telephone. She rang up Knoxville Central and asked for the Athens town operator. There were clicks and rings as the Athens operator came on the line. "This is a matter of life and death," Politzer told the operator, trying to sound breathless and urgent. "Congressman Taylor must speak with Senator Candler. I've been in Athens myself, and I know it is such a tiny place that you have only to look out of the door to know where Senator Candler is. You must find him for me." Within minutes, Herschel Candler came to the telephone.
"Cannot see my way clear to vote for amendment, period," Candler defiantly told his own state party chairman, who was pressing him to get on board for ratification. "My oath of office would not permit."
Candler repeated much the same thing to Politzer on the phone. Candler was hopeless. Back in Nashville, Josephine Pearson and the officers of the Southern Women's Rejection League announced an ingenious new project of cultural, historical, and political importance, a museum exhibit. It was to be the centerpiece of their new headquarters space in the Hotel Hermitage, made possible by Nina Pinkard's superb curatorial skills. "We have been able to secure, with great difficulty, the original United States Senate copies of the 3 force bills introduced in the last Congress to enforce the 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments if the latter is ratified," she explained to reporters. Any reference to force bills was poison in the southern states, Pinkard knew quite well, dredging up traumatic memories of federal enforcement of civil rights laws during Reconstruction, which Southerners considered an insulting encroachment into their state affairs. The current force bills introduced into Congress by Northern Republican pro-suffrage legislators sought to apply to the 19th Amendment, the second section of the 14th Amendment, which stipulated that any state that abridged the voting rights of its eligible citizens could have its representation in Congress reduced by the proportion of those so denied. If the federal suffrage amendment was ratified, a state that refused to allow black women or men to vote could be punished. "These force bills would rob the southern states of no less than 70 seats in Congress," Pinkard claimed, acknowledging that it was a matter of policy in the southern states to deny black citizens the vote. The infamous grandfather clause stipulating that only those men whose grandfathers had been eligible to vote could participate in current elections, eliminating virtually all black southern men whose grandfathers had been slaves, had been struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1915. But there were many other ways to prevent black men from voting. Exorbitant poll taxes and property requirements, arcane registration requirements, outrageous literacy and knowledge questions. Recite the state constitution was a favorite. Threat of job loss and brute physical intimidation did the trick just fine. Southern states despised any mention of force bills, with their dual threat of federal election oversight and diminished congressional power, even though neither oversight nor the threat of reduced representation had ever been carried out. Defending against Washington's prying eyes peeking into the polling place remained a priority for the southern states throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. The menacing force bills were only one provocative element of the Antis museum plans, as Mrs. Pinkard promised even more titillating artifacts. Photographs of Susan B. Anthony's black friends, for instance, plus photographs and documentary evidence of the true originators of the 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments, proving their common origin, Pinkard boasted. It was no secret that Frederick Douglass would appear in this section of the display. Another highlight of the exhibit, Pinkard revealed, would be a copy of the blasphemous Woman's Bible, written by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and edited and approved by Carrie Chapman Catt, proof of the suffragists' contempt for religion in general and Christian values in particular. This anti-ratification exhibit was going to be a blockbuster, Pinkard assured the press. As Carrie Catt and her entourage moved eastward toward Knoxville, the murmurs they'd been hearing about various plots to stymie ratification grew louder. All of them were frighteningly plausible. Some were actually true. The rosy prospect of a quick, favorable legislative majority faded, and Kat's mood grew darker. She heard whispers that Governor Roberts, frightened by all the legal complications surrounding ratification, would, even if he won renomination, simply abandon plans for the special session, preserving the electoral status quo for himself in the fall. Angry Tennessee suffs couldn't vote against him because they wouldn't have the vote in gubernatorial elections. Another version of this scenario, from very reliable sources, was that the governor would allow the session to convene, but his advisors, working with his loyal men in the legislature, were going to ditch the amendment, bury it in committee, until the 20-day lifespan of the special session expired. There were tales that three men, purporting to represent the Republican National Committee, were circulating among legislators, convincing them to stonewall ratification so Democrats could be denied the capstone of suffrage victory. In addition, the Rejection League was said to be teaming up with the Constitutional League to urge delegates to attend the special session but refuse to vote on ratification as a matter of honor, citing their oath of office qualms. There was even a report that one high-level Tennessee Republican leader was acting as a double agent, professing to work for ratification while actually doing his best to undermine it. Cat took these rumors of shenanigans very seriously and fired off a panic-tinged telegram to Republican National Committee Chairman Will Hayes. Report three Republicans here representing National Republican Committee opposing ratification. Hayes's reply did little to assuage her fears. Report is, of course, absolutely false, Hayes insisted. The RNC had passed many unanimous resolutions favoring ratification and is now doing all it can properly do to support the amendment, he explained. The RNC might deny any knowledge of this ruse in Tennessee, Kat believed, but that didn't mean it wasn't happening. Even if it was not officially sanctioned, even if it was a rogue operation, these men, whoever they were making a plausible enough pitch to be effective with jittery Republicans. Kat was fed up with both parties' empty resolutions and pale excuses of doing all it can properly do. The latest news accounts were also alarming. Reporters, sniffing around Nashville and digging in Washington and Ohio, were filing stories with headlines such as, Tennessee doubtful, politicians relieved, news that suffrage may not pass lifts burdens from candidates, and GOP leaders fear suffrage, and Suffs losing Tennessee. Harding won't help. Anita Politzer recognized the danger of this leadership vacuum and fumed as several of her East Tennessee legislators withdrew their ratification pledges on constitutional grounds. I believe liquor influence making great headway under pretense constitutionality, she reported. Situation extremely critical. The Republicans were equivocating, but so were the Democrats. Organizers report no signs of work being done by national leaders of either party in Tennessee, Alice Paul complained. Actually, Democratic National Committee Chairman George White had secretly wired every Democrat in the Tennessee legislature, urging them to commit to ratify in time for James Cox to announce an assured majority in his official nomination acceptance speech on August 7th. But the pledges were not coming in, and some of the responses the DNC did receive from Tennessee Democrats were certainly not positive. As to supporting proposed 19th Amendment, replied L.M. Whitaker, representing three counties in the south-central part of the state, to do so I will have to violate my oath to support the Constitution of Tennessee. We'll have to lower the standard of Southern womanhood. We'll have to grossly offend sister states by enforcing an obnoxious measure on them. We'll have to surrender the cordial principle of American government of states' rights. It will be a long step toward degrading American homes. We'll double the Negro purchasable vote of South. We'll sacrifice settled social and domestic ethics and customs for a supposed political expediency. There can be but one answer. Sue White was witnessing the Democratic resistance firsthand. Governor Roberts's men were not lining up to support ratification, she confided to Anita Politzer. By the latest Woman's Party count, the Suffs were 10 votes short in the House, 6 in the Senate, and some of the pledges White did have in hand were too iffy to be secure. Miss Sue was, she confessed, worn out. She was scared. When are you coming to Nashville? She begged Alice Paul. As all the Suffs, antis, and politicos sprinted around the state, they warily watched the calendar and eyed the clock. The state primary was just a few days away. The fate of the governor and the future of the amendment were riding on that election. The special session, if it happened at all, was to convene in less than a week. The suffragists' seven-decade quest for the vote was being squeezed into a mad dash. The Antis' cherished goal of protecting American civilization was being condensed into a tight time frame. And despite all the frenetic activity, ratification remained totally unpredictable. As the days passed, the uncertainties seemed only to multiply. By Monday, August 2nd, Kat was in Knoxville, giving speeches, meeting with local suffragists, and making the rounds of politicians. After another long, draining day, Kat finally retired to her hotel room, but exhaustion, anxiety, and the oppressively heavy air made sleeping difficult. Sometime in the night, Abby Milton was awakened by loud, insistent knocking on her door. She opened it to find Marjorie Schuller, wrapped in a robe, breathless, frantic. "Mrs. Kat has suffered a heart attack." It wasn't actually a heart attack, but Abby and Marjorie didn't know that in those first terrifying moments. All they knew was that their chief was stricken, wounded in the field, just as the decisive battle was nearing. Chapter 15. A Real and Threatening Danger. Kat had what people called a bad ticker. Her heart occasionally fluttered or skipped or squeezed painfully in her chest, took her breath away. The doctors told her to take it easy. Less stress, less strain, more rest was their usual prescription. She never obeyed those orders. Marjorie and Abby Milton found Kat dizzy, pale, and perspiring, but sitting upright and alert. "She was fine," she protested. "It was just one of her little spells. It would go away." Kat had not actually suffered a heart attack. It was most likely an episode of angina, a recurring symptom of her chronic heart ailment. It was unlikely to be fatal, even if it was very frightening. Kat had learned to live with it. Kat hated being ill, as if it revealed some embarrassing personal weakness or confirmed the silly stereotype of women as the weaker sex. Yet she'd had her share of health problems over the years, and her tendency to overwork to the point of exhaustion triggered numerous collapses. Even an iron will could not always compensate for a more fragile body. Kat spent the next day recuperating at the comfortable Milton home in Chattanooga, enjoying the quiet, a bit of pampering, and the three young Milton daughters, who were already veterans of many a suffrage parade. While Kat was cocooned in the pleasant hush of the Milton's house and garden, the ratification fracas grew hotter and louder. As news spread of Senator Harding's latest refusal to intervene with Republican Tennessee legislators, Harding also received a letter from the Tennessee Constitutional League. Whether the notes crossed in the mail or one precipitated the other isn't clear, demanding that Harding keep hands off in Tennessee. It assured Harding that he'd made a wise decision in holding back. The Constitutional League Guardian sent an identical letter to Cox and composed another set of sharp warnings to every Tennessee lawmaker. "We ask you, as a sworn officer of our state government, to stand with us for the upholding of the honor of Tennessee and the rights of our people as guaranteed in our Constitution," the letter to the legislators read. The letter was strong, but not strident. No histrionics, just very lawyerly. It conveyed a man-to-man ease and just the right tone of arrogance. "We feel justified in saying that you have not the right to foreclose your freedom of action by any promise, express or implied. Your own obligation to obey the Constitution rises above any party or personal consideration." In other words, any written or verbal pledges to vote for ratification should be, and must be, considered null and void, the Constitutional League claimed. And on the other side of the equation, any ill-advised pledges made by the presidential candidates to assist in passing ratification should also be repudiated. Carrie Catt, supposedly resting in Chattanooga, but still receiving up-to-the-hour reports by telephone, recognized that this was the ticking bomb with which the Antis planned to blow up the supporting structure of the Suf's campaign. She could sense the menace of this clever explosive device, even as she sat in the cool shade of the Milton house. It must be defused, or preemptively detonated. Never mind her heart. From the Milton's parlor, Kat dictated a set of stinging telegrams to Cox and Harding. There is a very real and threatening danger to ratification of the federal amendment by the Tennessee legislature, she told them, resulting from the tremendous effort being made by outsiders to persuade the legislators not to act on the amendment at all, under the pretense that it would be a violation of their oath. What's more, these outsiders are inspiring messages to you, she told the candidates, taking direct aim at the Constitutional League, signed by Tennessee names, asking you to keep hands off. Keeping hands on, Kat insisted, with a tight and forceful grip, was the only option if they honestly wanted to salvage the amendment. We renew our appeal to you for the aid we so greatly need in this last battle for women's political liberty. Kat's wires to the candidates, to Harding in particular, set off a cascade of sparks. Harding's patience for the whole ratification matter was fraying, as he was being harassed from all sides. The different camps of Suffs, the many varieties of Antis, the lawyers, the press, the Tennessee Republicans, and Will Hayes at the RNC. The national election was only 13 weeks away. Harding must focus, avoid mistakes, appear presidential. If he could hold on, allow Cox to make the unforced errors, and sidestep any controversial comments, he could win the White House. Harding sent Kat a quick, if hollow, reply.
Your telegram received. No discouragement is voiced from here. On the contrary, we are continuing to encourage the Republicans of the Tennessee General Assembly to join cordially in the effort to consummate ratification.
He really just wanted them off his back and off his porch. The reaction of the Woman's Party to Harding's newest evasions was precisely as he feared. They were already climbing his front porch steps. As soon as Alice Paul had gotten hold of Harding's equivocal response to the Harding Coolidge League, she dispatched Abby Baker to confront him on his porch in Marion. Baker carried her own weapon into the meeting. If not a stick, perhaps the equivalent of a dainty, pearl-handled derringer.
I impressed upon him that, unless the Tennessee legislature acted favorably, the ratification question was likely to become an incubus on the back of the Republican Party, Baker recounted to reporters.
And should Tennessee fail the women of America, the Woman's Party would have no choice but to assign blame and punish the offending National Political Party in the fall. She was threatening to unleash the woman's vote, a potent weapon, if it really existed.
What will the Negro woman do with the vote?
Mrs. Juno Frankie Pierce asked her audience of several hundred white women at the inaugural convention of the Tennessee League of Women Voters, held in the State House in May. Pierce, a founder of the Nashville Federation of Colored Women's Clubs and an active suffragist, answered that rhetorical question with an air of calm authority.
Yes, we will stand by the white women, Pierce explained.
Nashville's black suffrage clubs had coordinated closely with Catherine Kenney and the city's white suffrage organization to get out the vote in the 1919 municipal elections, the first open to Tennessee women.
We are optimistic because we have faith in the best white women of the country, of Nashville. We are going to make you proud of us because we are going to help you, help us, and yourselves.
It was an extraordinary moment. Hearing the voice of a black woman, the daughter of a slave, inside the House chamber of the Tennessee Capitol was astonishing. Kenny, with Abby Milton's approval, had invited Pierce to address this founding meeting of the League in a taboo-breaking experiment in political cooperation.
"We are interested in the same moral uplift of the community in which we live as you are," Pierce explained. "We are asking only one thing, a square deal."
Pierce was pledging the help of the black women of Tennessee to the white women of the state, proposing a working partnership to achieve their shared goals of social betterment. But Pierce's demand for a square deal wasn't just a vague, lofty notion. It wasn't just a promise to follow white women's instructions. It was solid and specific.
"We want recognition in all forms of this government," Pierce said. "We want a state vocational school and a child welfare department of the state, and more room in state schools."
The black and white suffragists of Tennessee had worked separately for many years. Black suffs weren't allowed to join the white mainstream clubs, so this event was an exciting departure, an ambitious way to launch the new Tennessee League of Women Voters, which was the successor to the state's national suffrage affiliate. With the granting of limited suffrage, Tennessee became eligible to join the LWV. Abby Milton and Catherine Kenney were elected to leadership positions of the League, and there was something thrilling to them about Pierce's idea of women forging political deals, joining forces, white and black, for their community's good. This was, they believed, perhaps naively, what woman suffrage in its purest, most idealistic form was all about. It was an example of what women's participation in government might accomplish. But Pierce was posing another question, urgent but unspoken, to her audience that morning. Will you, the white suffragists of Tennessee, stand by the black women of the state who want, who need, to vote? Will you stand up for us when black women, like black men, are threatened and assaulted at the polls? Will you allow us to use the vote that we, like you, have been fighting for so long? Those questions remained unanswered. Now, in the first days of August, the Tennessee League of Women Voters was only 10 weeks old, but it was being forced to mature quickly. No woman attending the inaugural convention could foresee that Tennessee might be the 36th state, or that their league would be thrust into the national spotlight while still in its wobbly infancy. Abby Milton, as the league's first president, accepted the challenge. Milton saw her role in guiding the young league as her civic duty, and she took such obligations very seriously. Both George and Abby Milton felt strongly about public affairs, good government, and progressive policies. George was the publisher and editor of the Chattanooga News, a careful and fair-minded man, a dry, a suff, and a progressive Democrat. He frequently locked editorial horns with his morning newspaper rival, Adolph Ox's Chattanooga Times, and with Edward Stallman's Nashville Banner. Abby's quick mind and organizational talents enabled her to rise quickly in suffrage circles, first in Chattanooga and then to the presidency of the state suffrage organization, where she played a leading role in pushing through the limited suffrage bill in the legislature. Abby believed God had a plan for the world, and woman's equality was just a necessary amendment to that plan. She felt called to do her part. While Carrie Catt was dictating her telegrams to Cox and Harding into the Milton's telephone, Abby was off in Johnson City, substituting for Mrs. Catt on the stage of a suffrage rally, an intimidating position for anyone. She summoned her courage and walked alone to the podium. When she returned home to Chattanooga, she found Carrie Catt directing the Tennessee campaign from the parlor couch. It was obvious that after barely one day of rest, Catt was going to jump back into the ruckus. There was no restraining her. Catt wouldn't hear of canceling her speech to the Chattanooga Chamber of Commerce, scheduled for the next day. She would go on as planned. At noon on Wednesday, August 4th, in the ballroom of the Hotel Patton, Catt was introduced by the mayor of the city, and among the audience of about 200 men and women were many political notables. Abby Milton and Marjorie Schuller sat at the head table, which was festooned with suffrage yellow flowers, their eyes anxiously fixed on Mrs. Cat as she rose to speak. But their worries about her health and stamina dissolved as she launched into her address. Cat spoke with an unfiltered fury that even Marjorie had never heard before.
"Here in Tennessee, the suffrage battle is being fought by those who do not live in Tennessee," Cat declared.
She was referring not to herself, but to the men of the Constitutional League.
"Their way is to put a few publicity-seeking women in the limelight, while they themselves work in stealth."
Cat presented her evidence, spinning her narrative like a detective story, turning her magnifying glass on the Constitutional League.
"Some weeks ago, from New York, came emissaries of this group to organize a men's Constitutional League in Tennessee, and they seem to be finding men willing to play into their hands," she charged. "They do not appear to be behind the opposition, but when they send to Cox and Harding messages to leave Tennessee alone, you may know it is this little band of determined New York reactionaries who are behind it."
Reporters covering the event scribbled furiously in their notebooks, smiling to themselves as they recorded Cat's colorful castigations.
"These are the same New York people who call women skirts and cry loudly that woman's place is in the home," Cat fumed. "The opponents of suffrage are trying to fool the people of Tennessee about the state constitution," she contended. "All the antis are getting behind the constitutional objection."
Cat was speaking without notes, taking off from her usual stump speech, inserting little rhetorical firecrackers. And she was getting a bit carried away.
"You can fool the people of Tennessee, but you can't fool posterity," she insisted. "If you won't consider the suffrage amendment, the action of the legislature will pass into history as a testimonial to the stupidity of Tennessee."
Marjorie and Abby Milton could only wince at this insulting swipe, so out of character for the diplomatic Cat.
"You may think you are right, but posterity will laugh."
It was as if all the tension and anger Cat had felt during the past several weeks, the bitter frustration she'd kept bottled up, were now bubbling out.
"Go to see your representatives and senators and set them right," she exhorted. "Let them understand that if they want to claim that their oaths prevent their considering suffrage, they do so in response to the wish and will of reactionaries, woman-haters, who hope to keep women disenfranchised forever."
The antis in Nashville were both outraged and elated by Mrs. Cat's remarks. They resented her jibes about outsiders and New York reactionaries invading and manipulating Tennessee. Who was she, a New Yorker herself, to point a finger? But they took Cat's febrile rants as proof that the Suffs felt themselves slipping, losing their grip. They were not wrong in this assessment. Josephine Pearson took special delight in Mrs. Cat's tirade, and used the nib of her fountain pen to puncture it. She had the fine hand of a teacher, her penmanship curvy and clear, her turns of phrase vivid, and her punctuation florid. Pearson was partial to exclamation points. They expressed her emphatic belief in the verities, her unshakable confidence in the absolute truths, in the word of God, and in the great philosophers of man.
"Can anything more outside in its influences than Mrs. Cat, an alien in blood and in sentiment to every southern instinct and inheritance, have ever come to Tennessee?"
she asked Cox incredulously. The anti-leaders and Constitutional League lawyers from New York and other places were not outsiders, she protested. They were invited, honored guests.
that we, opposing ratification in Tennessee, have and may employ every available ability, both state and national, to defeat the federal amendment that bears the name Susan B. Anthony, who was an organizer and propagator of abolition, out of which female suffrage is an unmistakable historical child, we do not deny, but proclaim. Woman's suffrage was an infectious germ foreign to the South, Pearson told Cox, and federal control of Southern elections was a Republican plot originating with the likes of Thaddeus Stevens and Frederick Douglass. No self-respecting Democrat should have any part in such a ploy, Pearson insisted, not if he hoped to win Southern votes. She advised Cox to ignore Mrs. Katz's hysterical pleas for his help, and to take Katz's SOS calls as proof that public sentiment in Tennessee was opposed to the amendment, and ratification would naturally fail without his intervention. Though Pearson might be exaggerating the strength of popular opposition to ratification, she had a salient point. The Suffs were obviously fearful that ratification in Tennessee was impossible without strong, coercive pressure from both national parties. They couldn't trust the strength of their own forces to achieve victory. Why, then, she asked Cox, should a distinguished Democratic candidate lend his efforts to pulling burnt suffrage chestnuts out of a Southern fire? While Pearson penned her letter to Cox at the Hermitage, two blocks away at Woman's Party headquarters, Sue White wrote asking for help. Handling the entire state campaign with only three organizers was too much. White expected Miss Paul to arrive in Nashville within the next few days. But in the meantime, Paul promised reinforcements. She was sending two staffers from headquarters to handle publicity and another to raise money. The situation in Tennessee is serious, but the situation of our treasury is more serious still, Emma Wald, Paul's secretary at party headquarters, wrote to a member that same week. Miss Paul asks me to write you to see if you cannot raise some money. Running on empty was certainly not a new condition for the Woman's Party. It was chronically short on funds, but the expenses of the long ratification campaign had sucked the party deep into the red. All the while she was supervising the Tennessee campaign from Washington, Paul continued begging for money. Need for money for Tennessee suffrage campaign urgent. Asking every state to contrib $100. Can you raise $100 in your state? Paul wired to all her state chairwomen. She made special appeals to her wealthiest donors, going back to the wells she'd tapped countless times before. Mrs. Havemeyer sent a $400 check. Paul pleaded with her well-heeled supporters to solicit funds from their neighbors at the posh summer colonies. She even asked Sue White, Anita Politzer, and Betty Graham to hustle money while they canvassed in Tennessee. By the early days of August, the Woman's Party treasury was down to $10, and the bills were pouring in. Paul was a brazen and guileless fundraiser. She was known to ask anyone at any time for money. She didn't enjoy doing it, but she felt that, like going to prison, begging for money was a necessary discomfort for the cause. She didn't wheedle, she didn't demand, she just asked directly, with the single-minded intensity with which she pursued all of her goals. She was hard to refuse. Donors often gave more than they intended, simply because in her sincerity she made them believe, or made them feel guilty. No one was safe in an elevator, or in a taxi, or even in a private box at Carnegie Hall, if Alice Paul had you alone and in her fundraising sights. How she kept the party afloat at all was miraculous. There were the small donors, the elderly woman sending a dollar bill or two, the nurse sending $5 of her salary, the child mailing a dime, and the more substantial checks from wealthier patrons. And then there was Mrs. Belmont. Alva Erskine Vanderbilt Belmont was perhaps the American suffrage movement's most flamboyant benefactor. Born on the Erskine family's cotton plantation in Mobile, Alabama, she married into high New York and Newport society when she took the hand of a Vanderbilt scion.
Years later, her divorce became one of the great tabloid stories of the Gilded Age. Her settlement made her a very wealthy divorcee. She quickly remarried into another society family, the Belmonts, but when she was widowed in 1908, she decided to devote herself, and her money, to the woman suffrage cause. Although she bankrolled the National at first, providing the money for their new